Welcome to Translating Proteomics, where we explore the science of proteomics and its growing impact on basic biological research, drug development, and more. And now your hosts, Parag Mallick and Andreas Humer of Nautilus Biotechnology.
Welcome back. We're delighted to have you with us as we talk about proteomics breakthroughs. And in particular, what we're going to talk about today is how it feels like we're on the cusp of yet another massive transition for the field of proteomics and another exponential leap. Before we dive into the future, I'd love to hear your perspectives as someone who really was there at the forefront of the first few waves of proteomics breakthroughs.
Yeah, well, when I was a grad student, I studied a single protein. By the time I, you know, entered the professional lives, my professional life, I was studying, you know, multiple proteins. With the progression of mass spectrometry and the performance and on the mass analyzer tools, you know, it became thousands, over the period of 20 years. And so today when, you know, we walk up to a modern...
So before we even get up to 20 years,
yeah.
Let's talk about the first five.
The first 5 years...
So we have electrospray.
We have electrospray. We have, you know, chromatography that's sufficiently small to actually be introduced into a mass spectrometer without overwhelming it. We start out with, you know, several hundred proteins. Mm-hmm. And back then we thought, you know, this was unbelievable. Yeah. Because, you know, nobody had observed, you know, proteins at that scale, with the exception, obviously, for 2D gels, where we are, you know, mm-hmm. counted more than 1,000 spots per, you know, 2D gel. But, you know, at this point, there was not a readout for 1,000 proteins. You had to individually pick all of them and analyze all of them. Yeah. But mass spectrometry would give you, immediately the readout. So, you know, 200, 300. And then as we improved our chromatography, we get several more hundreds. Yeah. We had 1,000 proteins very quickly.
And how did customers respond to that? What were they doing with this brand new power that was delivered?
I think there, you know, as always, there were some people who were cautious about the tool. Particularly when they didn't see their protein of interest on, you know, on the output, they thought maybe that's not their tool. Obviously, there were the people who saw, you know, how we'd eventually get to thousands of proteins and how exciting that would be. You had both camps, and obviously, you know, we didn't stop at a few hundred or even at a few thousand. We ultimately pushed the technology all the way to, you know, looking at a proteoform, you know, comprehensively now within, mm-hmm. you know, several hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember in the early days, there were actually, I remember two very distinct camps. I remember a camp that was using mass spectrometry as a signal and just looking at patterns of mass spectra, not even able to identify the proteins.
Mm, yeah.
And how even that was very exciting because you saw these biological differences. And then there was that was growing up at the same time as the ability to measure low hundreds of proteins. But then there was a transition towards, no, we absolutely need to be able to identify these peaks. We can't live just in a peak world. And so there was this leap towards really being able to not just say that a protein was there, but to quantify how much was there. And that was really a transition towards it being a tool of biologists and being able to ask biologically interesting questions.
Yeah. I feel despite all these advances, and obviously when you go from, you know, working on a single protein to being able to see the proteome comprehensively, mm-hmm. I still think we're falling short of a lot of things. I mean, these are mostly compositional studies that we can do really mm-hmm. well, but we really haven't captured, you know, the dynamics of the cellular systems or the biological systems we're studying. So, despite the fact that if you plot that on, you know, a Moore's type law plot, mm-hmm. you know, proteomics and the tools have actually progressed much faster in terms of performance than you would see, you know, or correlate with a typical computer chip, right? But that still isn't sufficient to actually need, you know, get us where we need to be.
I think that's a great point. I think one of the other lessons that we really, if we go back in time and we look at some of the challenges that we saw in the past and maybe take some lessons from it. Around the early 2000s, there were a series of incredibly provocative articles that argued that proteomics technologies, CellD in particular, would be able to differentiate ovarian cancer patients with 100% sensitivity, 100% specificity. And then those were followed by a series of articles explaining why those first articles, what they'd done wrong, either in terms of their data analysis or in terms of how the samples were collected and stored, systematic biases and pre-analytical variables. And so I think there are some technical things we can learn there about both how sensitive the proteome is to variation, sample collection, pre-analytical variables. I think there are also some lessons learned about overpromising and underdelivering, and there being this latent wave of humility and doing the rigorous work, demonstrating the proof points, and slowing the progression so that you really are doing those analytical studies with the community in the loop. So I think we have an opportunity, and it feels like that we are poised for a breakthrough in proteomics. It feels like there's tremendous inertia. Just one example, my colleague Sharon Pateri and I teach a proteomics course at Stanford. And we go back 5-6 years, we had maybe 20 people in the class. Last year, there were maybe 40 people in the class. This year, there are 80 people in the class. So just using that as a barometer, it feels like proteomics is ready for another wave, another renaissance. Why? What's changed?
Well, I see more general interests. If you go to meetings, particularly if you go to a genomic meeting, people are approaching us and say, hey, we want to know more about the proteome. I think we understand what we get from the genomic tools, but we really need to understand more about the proteins. And so having a, scientist that's focused on genomics saying, hey, I need to know more about some other area, I think is a pretty big indication that, we are, poised to have a big breakthrough here.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there are really two pieces when I think about it. One is from a technological perspective, a foundational perspective, the existing tools reached a point where they were demonstrating the tremendous value of the proteome routinely. And that whet people's appetite to say, oh, wow, this is great. What could I do with even newer alternative methods and complementary tools and really looking at a whole ecosystem? So I think one is really driven by technology. I think the other is driven really by examples in precision medicine and others where finding that the genome and the transcriptome weren't sufficient to affect the tremendous wave of precision medicine that we'd hoped for. I think just recognizing that we need to combine multiple types of data together in order to really do a better job of predicting and understanding biology. So I feel like we're at this convergence of two completely disparate waves that are crashing into each other and leading to this momentum.
Yeah, there's probably also maybe a general generational change in the scientific leadership that we're observing. Maybe it's also the general generational change of scientists that we see that all come together and build this confluence of we need to know more about the protein as well as maybe the metabolites, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And so as you think forwards, 5 years, 10 years, and you think about, so we're on the verge of this proteomics breakthrough. We get through the breakthrough.
Yeah.
We're able to proteomicize tremendously. What have we learned? What have we used these powerful new tools to accomplish?
Well, I think, you know, I think we're going to be able to really appreciate the dynamic nature of the proteome and how that dynamic nature supports the survival of, you know, the organism or the, you know, humans that need to adapt to the environment. I think that's what we'll see.
Okay.
And then I think we'll be having many implications around, you know, how do we address health and disease questions, right? How do we address other problems that we'll have? Because I not only think about the human aspect of proteomics, but there is, you know, plants. There's many other aspects that we are not really thinking about today because current tool sets are limited. Now, in case of mass spectrometry, we're not limited to looking at plants. We have those genomes and we have those databases. But, you know, the typical other tool sets like antibodies are not very common in those spaces.
Yes.
Right? So I would think that that is probably something we're going to cross you know, over very quickly.
That's interesting. So I'm excited about those advances. I'm excited about our potential to unlock precision medicine and do a better job of diagnosing people, because I think those signals are contained substantially in the proteome. I'm also excited about the ability to look at things sufficiently well that we can learn what we don't have to look at. So we see, hey, yeah, this protein, it wiggles a lot. Those wiggles are not interesting. That's just how it works. It's not a disease protein because it's wiggling. Versus this other protein that maybe it's super stable all the time. And then in a disease condition, it spikes. And so being able to reduce the complexity, so which you can only do if you look at everything.
Yeah. And I think you're making a good point, because I think when you read even those compositional papers very carefully, it's very clear from the data set that, you know, probably 80 to 90% of the proteome actually never really changes that much.
Yeah.
And it's only a few hundred proteins at any point in time that really change.
So that point in time is really, is I think, also key, because we certainly expect there are proteomes that are changing during embryogenesis, during development, during extreme aging processes. And so understanding which segments of the proteome are required just for cells to be cells, for homeostasis, which ones are required for humans to grow in the first place and then they get shut off, that context of which proteins we need to pay attention to when, I'm excited about us diving in and being able to explore all those questions.
Yeah. Brings up another interesting topic in that context, right? When we think about proteomics breakthrough, I think we need another breakthrough in another area that you should be familiar with in the bioinformatics field. Never heard of it.
No.
We have very strange nomenclature for proteins or names for proteins.
Yes.
So it is incredibly difficult to communicate. And if you just read some papers where there's abbreviations for all of this, you basically lose the context often, because you know, lose what these different proteins mean.
Yeah.
So I think we need another breakthrough where we find maybe new ways to name all the things we observe in the protein space. What do you think?
Well, I imagine that the folks who particularly need this are in Drosophila genetics, where you have hedgehog, sonic hedgehog, frizzled, and you know, these came from observing phenotypes of growing flies. But these genes, proteins do so much more than that. And so I think there's an opportunity for systematization that will make communication easier.
So what do you think about if we, instead of giving them names or numbers or random numbers, we give them a timestamp or a spatial location the way that we give to geolocations, right? I mean, you could even give proteins several of them and says it appears here and here and here and here during this and this and this time. It would be a complete change. And I mean, it would be difficult to describe them.
I mean, if you think about star charts, for instance, that's, you know, stars have an index and then they have a chart that overlays on top of that index.
Yeah.
So I suspect that what we might need is a more multidimensional index. So we need a unique identifier for a thing, and then we need something to describe its state and trajectory over time.
Yeah.
And so it may be that we just need to expand to a more sophisticated lexicon to describe both identity and trajectory.
Yeah. I think it's really hard right now to sort of keep track of biology because we, you know, we gave them the best name we could give them at that point, ascribing some kind of function to it.
Yeah.
But it I think it's going to be insufficient moving forward. And I think we need a breakthrough in that area.
Yeah. I mean, when we think about, to me, one of the other opportunities and also one of the reasons why I think we're on the cusp of a breakthrough is systematization. So if you go back 10, 15 years, every lab had their own protocol for how they did sample preparation.
Yeah.
They had their own approach to how they ran the mass spectrometer. They had their own approach for how they analyzed the data.
Yeah.
In genomics, that didn't really exist. There tended to be a common set of common pipelines that were used. And I feel like we as a field have converged so much more on a narrower set of best practices and a narrower set of analytic approaches. And that's also why we're able to leverage studies across labs so much more. So when I think about our next generation, our next breakthrough, I do think there's a huge analytical component of how do we combine this data with other data? How do we look at it over time? How do we describe this transition from genome, from gene to transcript, to protein, to proteoform, to spatial protein? So I do think that will be part of the breakthrough. Thanks so much for joining us today. I had so much fun sitting down with Andreas to hear his perspectives about where proteomics came from and about this impending breakthrough. On our next episode, we're going to talk about the applications of proteomics. And I'd also love to hear from all of you. Why do you believe that we're on the cusp of a breakthrough? What do you believe that this breakthrough is going to enable us to do in the next year, 5 years, 10 years, 50 years? Reach out to us. Can't wait to hear your thoughts.
We hope you enjoyed the Translating Proteomics podcast, brought to you by Nautilus Biotechnology. To contact us or for further information, please email translatingproteomics@nautilus.bio.